Legal, law, and politics all covered quite often at the Miami Book Fair International. When the tough on crime politics of the 1980s overcrowded state prisons, and you heard us mention this yesterday, the Costello ruling that said just how many prisoners you could have in a cell, private companies saw potential profit in building and operation of correctional facilities. Today, more than 100,000 of the 1.5 million incarcerated Americans are held in private prisons in 29 states and federal corrections. Private prisons are often criticized for making money off mass incarceration to the tune of $5 billion in annual revenue. Based on Lauren Brooke Eisen's work as a prosecutor, journalist, and attorney at policy think tanks, Inside Private Prisons blends investigative reporting and quantitative and historic research to analyze privatized corrections in America. Lauren Brooke Eisen will be at the Miami Book Fair, and she joins us live today on WNDB's Mark Bernier program. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Lauren, you were in the business of helping putting people away. Are people worse off if they're sentenced to a private prison than a state facility, or are they better off?
Well, that's one of the questions that I examine in this book, which focuses on the intersection of profit and incarceration. And one of the questions I ask is, what does it mean for a for-profit company to manage jails and prisons? And I looked at the differences between government-run prisons and jails and privately operated and owned ones. And it's hard to compare them, but at the end of the day, government-run facilities, jails and prisons, have their own share of problems, and privately owned facilities also have their own share of problems. It depends on, you know, what prison you're in or what jail you're in. Just walking around a private facility, you may not feel that it's that different from a government-run one. But I think one of the big differences is that the private prison industry is suffering from a lack of transparency and accountability. And that's something that's pretty significant.
Don't they have to answer to state regulators, regular inspections, all of that, to make sure they're doing things on the up and up?
They do, but it varies. So some states may have pretty tight regulations, pretty tight contracts. I visited some private prisons in New Mexico where a government, employee of the state of New Mexico Department of Corrections is physically on site and has an office at the private prison. So he's there every day. In some situations, the monitors may drive around, like in Florida. There's an independent monitor, but they drive around and sort of show up from time to time at these prisons. So the oversight really varies. And what's also important is that in some states, these private facilities are not subject to transparency requirements, such as freedom of information laws, the same way that government prisons are. And that is a real problem when we talk about transparency and accountability inside these facilities.
This book really attacks the mass incarceration movement. I've been told this, I'm not sure if it's true, Lauren, that per capita we have more people occupying prison space in this country than any other modernized country in the world. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. And what a lot of people don't know is that in the U.S., we have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's incarcerated population. So that really shows you how many people we incarcerate in this country. And that doesn't even include the thousands of people who are behind bars in immigration detention facilities. And a lot of those facilities are also privatized.
I'm going to be a devil's advocate, if you will, in this. Isn't a lot of this driven simply by cost? Taxpayers don't want to build more prisons. There's complaints that we have people in there that shouldn't be serving time in prison, though, and maybe doing something else. These private prisons, Lauren, by and large, are they for capital criminals, hardened criminals, or are they for white-collar criminals? Tell us about it.
Well, in most states, these private prisons house a low-security population. So these are incarcerated individuals who may need less programming, less services, less health care, even less correctional officers to watch over them. And that's very deliberate, because what a lot of these state governments have decided is that it's easier when they have overcapacity issues when they have crowding in their own jails and prisons, it's easier to send the low security population to these private prisons. They've sort of outsourced that to the private sector. And that's typically the population that you're going to see inside these private facilities. It may vary. Just this week, Nevada announced that they are sending 200 incarcerated individuals to a private prison in Eloy, Arizona, and that population is actually a higher security population. But for the most part, we're talking people who are sort of, you know, lower risk individuals, lower security risk.
Lauren, has the Justice Department weighed in on this issue?
They have. And what's really interesting is that under the Obama administration, Attorney General Sally Yates issued a memorandum to the Bureau of Prisons telling them that that the Justice Department was going to stop relying on private industry to house its incarcerated population at the federal level. And they made this decision partly based on an Inspector General report that indicated some problems within the private prisons at the federal level. Additionally, the federal prison population started to go down under the Obama administration. And that's why you may rely on private prisons, is because you want to be able to say, I no longer need to rely on these prisons. I can reduce my capacity. I'm going to shut down this prison. But what's really interesting is that under the Trump administration, almost as soon as Attorney General Sessions became, you know, the head of the Justice Department, he issued a one-paragraph memorandum completely reversing Attorney General Yates' memo. And his memo just said, we're going to keep relying on private prisons at the federal level.
According to in your book, impoverished rural towns often try to lure the for-profit prison industry to build facilities and create new jobs. Neither an endorsement or demonization, this book details the complicated and perverse incentives rooted in the industry. What kind of things do communities throw at the private prison industry to get them to come?
Well, and this is part of the exploration of the book. You know, I spoke to mayors, I spoke to county commissioners, I spoke to incarcerated individuals, their families, you know, people who own shops in some of these towns. You know, I spoke to people at coffee shops. And while at the policy level, many people may, you know, say that they are focused on reducing incarceration and may talk about, you know, the need to downsize prison populations, when you start talking to people who live in small towns across the country, a lot of them have lured, you know, not just private prisons, public prisons as well, into their communities because they're a huge source of economic development. And I visited some small towns when I was writing this book. Specifically, I spent some time in Appleton, Minnesota. And there's a really interesting story there about a prison that the town built. And at various points, it's had incarcerated individuals. Right now, it's completely shuttered. And CoreCivic owns the real estate. And the state is deciding, you know, what it's going to do with this what's called turnkey facility. You know, there are a lot of, you know, I think your question was, how do they lure this industry into their town? And what they may do is also give the industry tax breaks. And, you know, the other sort of flip side of that is that the industry will sometimes lure the towns into these contracts, you know, provide funding for the Rotary Club, tell them that they're going to, you know, build streets, you know, increase funding for various things so that, you know, the town gets a pretty good profit off of the industry.
There was a story in Florida about a concern that the private industry had that they had these, and these were at state facilities. You had, in essence, the state going into competition with the private sector by making things like binders for school children and things like that. It's sort of a work-in-prison program, gives them something to do, maybe teaches them a trade. There was a worry that the product that was produced in prison might infringe on the private sector selling. Has that issue been one that you've explored?
I do explore that in the book, this idea of making money off of, you know, those who are incarcerated, specifically the products that they make. And it is interesting because, you know, sometimes the incarcerated individuals will want to be part of these job programs, these training programs, because it makes them more attractive once that they are released back into the community. You know, they can put something on their resume. On the other hand, there's this issue of exploitation. You know, all of these incarcerated individuals who are building desks and, you know, working at call centers inside these prisons are getting paid pennies on the dollar. And, you know, whether, I think the question is not whether people who are incarcerated work. The question really is how to compensate them properly. And what you're getting at, I think, is that they're not being compensated even at the minimum wage rate. So a lot of, you know, industries who employ people in the community who are not incarcerated just can't compete with the government, you know, paying 50 cents an hour to individuals who are incarcerated.
Lauren, the movie, and you can't go by this, Shawshank Redemption, which is based on a true story, actually has part of the storyline dedicated to a point in which the prisoners were involved in logging operations, I believe, in Maine, competing with local companies. Didn't Congress work to stop that? This is a state prison that had its inmates, you know, doing cutting down trees. Aren't there laws that prevent people using them as, in essence, slave labor in prison?
That is a complicated question. In almost every state prison in the country, incarcerated individuals are allowed, in fact, sometimes required to work. There are certain rules and regulations about, you know, whether their products can be sold across state lines. So what you tend to see in these prisons is that almost every single state has something called, let's say, Colorado, you know, Colorado Corrections Industries or Kentucky Corrections Industries. And so the way it works is in most of these prisons, the incarcerated individuals are employed making products for that industry, such as desks or license plates.
To get back to the private sector, how is this a growing field in all states? Does your book talk about what states may be the greatest concern to you?
So in terms of who uses private prisons, there are private prison facilities across 29 states and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. So it's in a these prisons are in a majority of the states. But something that a lot of people are just not aware of is that over 50%, in fact, some of the statistics have cited that almost 75% of the beds inside immigration detention facilities are privatized. And what that means is that these big corporations like CoreCivic and GEO Group own and operate most of the immigration detention beds in this country. So the privatization of the criminal justice system is much larger than just state prisons and federal prisons. It also has started to gobble up the immigration detention populations. And they tend to be in Texas, California, Arizona, some of these border states. You know, and additionally, the book explores the privatization of justice above, you know, just private prisons. So it looks at the entire prison industrial complex, which includes companies like JPay that provide, you know, internet services and, you know, telephone services to incarcerated individuals, and they charge a lot of money, or private probation. The prison industrial complex is very vast and is very alive and well in this country.
So what's the bottom line on this? Are you hoping for a change and move away from private prisons?
So the bottom line is something that I struggled with as I was writing this book. You know, when I looked at what does the increasing reliance on the private prison industry since the 1980s mean for the American justice system, and I suggest and I recommend some solutions toward the end of the book. So I focus on how the state and federal government should ensure contracts with these prisons, the private prisons, contain incentives that focus on reducing recidivism and improving outcomes for so many of the people who are behind bars in these facilities. I focus on the need to increase transparency and accountability in these prisons. But I think what's really important at the end of the day is that even if we change these outcomes, even if we improve recidivism rates at these private prisons, I interviewed a lot of incarcerated individuals and their families, some of whom said they actually, you know, enjoyed their time at a private facility a little bit better because they had more freedom. They might have been able to have Xboxes and things that were outlawed in the government prisons. But when I asked them, you know, how do you feel when you realize you're at a private facility, almost every single incarcerated individual or formerly incarcerated individual I spoke to said, it makes me sick. You know, it makes me very upset when I think someone is profiting off of my incarceration. So this is really more than just a story about outcomes and recidivism rates. It's also a story about, you know, what it means to profit off of incarceration.
I often ask authors this question. I say, are you going to be presenting in a solo appearance? Are you part of a larger panel discussion so that when our listeners are attending the Miami Book Fair International at Miami-Dade College, they know where to look for you?
Absolutely. So I will be on a panel with Yale Law Professor James Foreman and American University Law Professor Angela Davis. The panel is called Race in America. It will be held on Saturday, November 18th from 11:30 to 12:30 in room 8202.
Okay, so people will be able to see you at the Miami Book Fair at Miami-Dade College. The Wolfson campus will be broadcasting live, of course, presented by Brown & Brown Insurance and by Florida Power & Light. Lauren Brooke Eisen, thank you so much for being with us. Good luck to you at the Miami Book Fair. Hope to see you there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.